Again, we've got just a couple things. We'd like to have a discussion of the most recent forecast, which was interesting. Obviously, we also have the proposed confirmation of the commissioner. So we have, I think on the agenda, we have at the outset the discussion of the forecast. We have the commissioner and Dr. Kolomakidis. So if you'd like to begin, let us. You know, we know kind of the broad numbers, but want to get into some detail as to what you're thinking and what we might expect. So, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come this morning. State Economist Laura Kolomakidis and I are happy to be here to talk about the February forecast. Budget Director Margaret Kelly is going to join us a little bit later if she can. But we just want to, first of all, talk a little bit about the February forecast, some of the broad strokes, and also some of the details. All the material that we were talking about today is available on MMB's website at mn.gov/MMB under the tab labeled Forecast and Updates. But let me start off right away with the good news, and that is the forecast balance has increased by $832 million. The available balance for the next biennium is now $1.869 billion. Now, you have a copy of a slide deck, I think, in front of you, and the first sort of page talks about the forecast summary. And this will kind of go over the bullets about what topics we're going to cover today. But what I want to really start off with is that the long-term budget outlook for Minnesota remains strong. The story in Minnesota is that we are seeing projected growth in revenues and projected reductions in spending. Professor Kolomakidis will provide the details about the improving economic situation and, in particular, about the improved GDP growth projections that we see. But if you look at the next slide, I'll just go through the numbers in terms of how the biennia are affected by this new February forecast. So the first one is labeled higher revenues and lower spending. And you can see that relative to the November forecast, in terms of what's changed since the November forecast, we see higher revenues and lower spending projections. So if you look at the revenue line, the revenues are now projected to increase by $67 million, and the spending line shows that the projections for spending will decline by $39 million. So the combination of these forecast changes increased the ending balance by $105 million for this biennium. So in November, you may recall that the November forecast showed a balance of $373 million for this current biennium. That was after we had made an additional input to the reserve. But so if you go to the next page, you can see what this new balance increase means for the next biennium. So now we're looking at the fiscal year 2016-2017 budget outlook, and this has also improved. So if you take a look at the chart, you see that there's an increase in the beginning balance on the very top of the line. And second, we have an increase of $616 million in the projected revenues. We have a projected decrease in the spending of $115 million from the November forecast. These numbers add up to show an increase of $832 million for the next biennium and a new projected balance of $1.869 billion. Now, I want to point out one line in particular on this chart, and that is the reserve line. The reserve includes both the cash reserve and the budgeted reserve, sometimes called a rainy day fund. In 2014, we increased the reserves by $333 million. First, as you will recall, last year during the session, we added $150 million to the budget reserve, and we also made a new change in law that made an automatic reserve increase for the November forecast. It requires a third of that, any balance in November, to be automatically added to the reserve. And as you recall, in November, with the November forecast, there was a balance, and one-third of that balance, $183 million, was automatically added to the reserve. Thus, we have a new high reserve amount of $1.344 billion. Now, there is no automatic reserve addition for the February forecast. Just a few comments, and I'll turn it over to Professor Kolomakidis. Over the last several years, we have made some significant changes. Many of you will recall that 6 years ago, 4 years ago, and even 2 years ago, we were looking at budget deficits during this process. But by focusing on balanced budget principles, we now have an opportunity to look at forecast balances for the next two biennia. We've paid back the money that we borrowed from the schools. We've enhanced our revenues for the state. We've strategically invested in education. We've carefully managed the state budget, and in part we've increased by increasing our reserve. We've implemented strong management ideas like renegotiating health care contracts that saved over $1 billion alone in that particular case. Minnesota really is a success story. We have a balanced and diverse economy. We have the fifth lowest unemployment among the states and a growing economy. As I mentioned, we face budget balances now for the next two biennia, and we need to work together as we prepare a budget for the remainder of this legislative session and work together to come up with a balanced budget. So now I'll turn it over to Professor Kalambakidis.
Professor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you, Myron. So I want to talk about the economic outlook, both for the U.S. and Minnesota, and the chart on the next chart in your pack says the title, the outlook for U.S. economic growth has improved since we prepared the forecast in November of 2014. So since then, since the November 2014 forecast, we have learned that the U.S. added 3 million jobs in the past year, so in 2014, the strongest growth, 3 million jobs in the past year, the strongest growth since the late 1990s. The U.S. unemployment rate has fallen to 5.7%. And that ability to those conditions are creating the ability to find and to keep good jobs. That, combined with improved household purchasing power, are improving consumer confidence, which is high, and that confidence is buoying real consumer spending. And that change, the change in the outlook for real consumer spending in 2015 is the largest driver of the change in the U.S. outlook for real GDP growth in 2015. So the increase in the outlook that you see on the chart for 2015, the largest driver there is consumer spending. So the chart, of course, shows IHS Economics' February 2015 baseline outlook. It calls for real GDP growth to pick up from 2.2% in 2013 to 2.4% in 2014, the highest annual growth rate since 2010. And of the last quarter of 2014, real GDP growth has been slightly decreased since these were released. So comparing November forecast to February forecast, IHS has slightly increased their overall growth expectations for 2014 to 2019. The largest change, as you can see in the chart, occurs early in the forecast. So it's that change in 2014 and then the change in 2015. So projected real GDP growth in 2015 has increased from 2.6% last November to 3% in their February outlook. IHS now expects 2.7% real GDP growth in 2016 and 2.8% in 2017. So against this backdrop of job market changes and consumer confidence changing the U.S. real GDP growth outlook, against this backdrop, two developments are shaping the U.S. economic outlook: sharply lower oil prices and a stronger dollar. The oil price drop, which has since fluctuated since the February outlook was released, but that is due to both sluggish global demand and increased supply, some of which is coming from the United States, some of which is coming from our neighbor North Dakota. And those changes, sluggish global demand and increased supply, have sent crude oil prices well below expectations. So the price of a barrel of Brent crude at the time that we were presenting the February forecast, or the time that the IHS's outlook was prepared, had fallen by almost half since last June. Retail gasoline prices, you know, have ticked up in recent weeks on news of problems in refineries. But lower gasoline prices still mean savings for gasoline consumers and for businesses that use petroleum products. That's the positive side of the lower gasoline prices. The negative side for the U.S. outlook is that lower gasoline prices also mean reduced capital investment and drilling exploration by domestic energy producers. But because the U.S. is a net energy importer, the positive benefits from lower oil prices will likely outweigh the negative impacts, and that's the consensus among commentators and analysts of this. Meanwhile, the relative strength of the U.S. economy and the potential for rising interest rates here in the United States, so while the U.S. Federal Reserve is moving toward away from accommodative monetary policy toward more normal monetary policy, other central banks are continuing with their easing or their accommodative monetary policy, and some are restarting that. That difference in monetary policies is giving people the expectation of interest rates in the increasing in the United States, and that's attracting foreign investment. In the United States increases the demand for the U.S. dollar, and so that pushes up the value of the U.S. dollar. The trade-weighted dollar is up more than 17% against major trading partners since June. Now, a stronger dollar increases the cost of U.S. exports, so American products are more expensive overseas, and that decreases the demand for U.S. exported goods, including Minnesota's exports. It also increases imports by lowering the cost of foreign goods in the United States. So the higher dollar broadens or widens the U.S. trade balance. So both of these factors, falling energy prices and lower-priced imported consumer goods, place some temporary downward pressure on inflation, and that's in the IHS economics forecast is lower inflation, actually a period of deflation in in this year, but with prices rising thereafter. So the IHS February outlook, economic outlook, depends on a number of things. It depends on stronger labor market conditions translating into improvements in household formations, which boosts the housing recovery. And it depends on those conditions also improving labor force growth, so drawing the remaining slack in the labor market into the labor market. IHS expects productivity growth to rebound to the long-term trend of 2% per year. They expect the Federal Reserve's actions moving toward more normalized monetary policy. They expect those actions that transition to go smoothly this year. They assume that the Fed, in the February baseline, IHS assumes the Fed begins to raise the federal funds rate in June of this year, adding a point or 100 basis points by the end of this year. Federal fiscal policy is also assumed not to detract further from economic growth. And international and economic and political risk is also assumed not to further slow global economic growth. Moving to Minnesota's economy, the two developments that are affecting the U.S. economy, lower oil prices and the strong dollar, will have an impact here as well. A strong dollar will make Minnesota-produced goods and commodities more expensive in Canada, Europe, and elsewhere in the world, likely reducing demand for our products, including our agricultural products, abroad. Regarding the low oil prices, we know that some Minnesota businesses have benefited from the oil and gas boom in neighboring North Dakota. But Minnesota itself, as you know, is not an oil-producing state. Minnesota's overall economic performance is more a reflection of our fundamental economic assets, such as a large and diverse economic base, an educated workforce, and a large, thriving metropolitan area. So while some Minnesota firms will see declining opportunities in the related to the Bakken oil region, a potential slowdown in the Bakken, the net positive effects from the recent decline in crude prices, cheap gasoline for Minnesotans, will likely outweigh the negative impacts on the energy sector. Of course, as we've been watching, oil prices and gasoline prices have both changed since we produced our forecast, and so those fluctuations and that volatility will change those outcomes as well. The next chart, titled Minnesota's Economic Expansion Continues, shows the headline unemployment rates for Minnesota and the United States. Minnesota is the light line, and the U.S. is the dark line. I'm sorry, the opposite. Minnesota is the dark line, U.S. is the light line. Minnesota's labor market firmed up or tightened up considerably last year. The unemployment rate at 3.6% in December is a full two percentage points lower than the U.S. rate, and as the commissioner said, it's the fifth lowest among states. And among large metropolitan regions, the Minneapolis-St. Paul area has the lowest jobless rate of 3.3%. And over the last 12 months, the unemployment rate has fallen in all of our regional centers in Minnesota. And I'd like you to note in looking at that chart that the 3.6% where we sit now is below the low point of the previous economic expansion in 2002 to 2007. So we're 0.3 percentage points below that point, but above the low point of the prior great expansion at 2.5% in 1999. So to be clear, the vertical bars are the U.S. recessions, and the white space between them is the recovery and expansion period. So you can also see from that chart that the current recovery and expansion period, by the time we get to this summer, we will be at the length of the previous recovery and expansion, and the current recovery and expansion is already longer than longer than the average post-war expansion. So in addition to the headline unemployment rate being low and below the U.S. level, many of our leading labor market indicators in Minnesota remain strong. The number of Minnesotans filing new claims for unemployment benefits is back to levels not seen since the 1990s. Other indicators such as average hours worked for private employers, temporary help employment, and job vacancies are also all at levels consistent with a firming labor market. So our forecast, our economic and revenue forecast, depends on the IHS economics forecast coming true. So it has those same dependencies as the IHS forecast. And we separately also assume, or our forecast depends on, the stronger labor market conditions, increasing household formation, so boosting the housing recovery, and putting upward pressure on wages. And that wage acceleration is and increased job opportunities should draw, as for the U.S., should draw the remaining slack in the labor market into the workforce. So moving to the next slide to talk a bit more about wages, the chart that's titled...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just ask one question before I lose my train of thought here. Doctor, you talked about the federal budgeting system that didn't have an effect on Minnesota. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Senator. What I believe you're referring to is in the assumptions or the dependencies for the macro forecast. One of the assumptions that IHS Economics is making is that federal fiscal policy is not going to detract. From U.S. economic growth in the period of the forecast, and so they're sort of looking back to the era of federal fiscal impasses and the federal government shutdown and those kinds of things, and saying we expect federal fiscal policy to move smoothly and not to detract from U.S. economic growth. So our forecast depends on their forecast, so we sort of roll that assumption in.
Thank you.
So to continue the chart that says stronger wage growth expected in Minnesota, to be clear and to kind of fix ideas here, that bar chart shows our forecast for annual nominal wage and salary disbursements, so annual growth in wage and salary disbursements in Minnesota. So it is not it's not average wages, it's total wage and salary payments. And so those numbers can grow because employment has grown or because average wages have grown or both, or a combination of both. And so we're showing our forecast for nominal wage growth in November and then in our February forecast. Minnesota nominal wage income grew 3.1% in 2013. So at the time we were preparing our February forecast, information from the BEA, the quarterly census for employment and wages, as well as our own observations of income tax withholding receipts or withholding collections, suggests that wage growth rebounded to 4.3% in 2014. And that's stronger than the 3.9% growth we anticipated in November. So the observations of withholding receipts, in addition to the information we had from BEA, told us that we were seeing some growth in wages, which we had anticipated growth in wages, but it was higher in 14 than what we had expected. So that informs our forecast going forward, in addition to the macroeconomic variables informing that. Wage income is now expected to accelerate to 5.4% in Minnesota in 2015 and 4.8% in 2016. In November, our forecast called for some wage acceleration, but at lower rates of 4.4% in 15 and 4.6% in 16. So this wage income growth, especially that growth that we have in the forecast for this year, together with increased forecast for capital gains income and for consumer spending, helped to improve the forecast for FY16-17 revenues. So the table titled Individual Income and Sales Tax Receipts illustrates that. As you heard from Commissioner Franz, total general fund revenues for FY16-17 are now forecast to be $42.497 billion. Or $616 million more than the November forecast, and that's adjusted for the law changes that occurred in January of this year. Total tax revenues for the biennium are forecast to exceed the prior estimate by $520 million. Expected income and sales tax receipts account for nearly all the change in forecast tax revenues. The individual income tax, as you can see on the table, shows the largest dollar amount of the change, $393 million, above the prior estimate. Higher forecast wage growth in tax years 2015 and 16 and higher expected capital gains realizations in 2015 are primarily responsible for that change. Sales tax receipts are now forecast to be $124 million more than the November estimate, reflecting increased expectations for growth in the taxable sales tax base. So we simulate or proxy the sales tax base and then forecast that. And so that has been increased. And the reason for that, part of the reason for that change is the improved expectations for real consumer spending I talked about earlier. The difference between tax revenues and total revenues is non-tax revenues and other resources, which add $94 million to the revenue forecast relative to November. So before I pass this on to Budget Director Kelly, I just want to note that as we typically forecast a biennium and we move through that biennium over time and we update the forecast at each stage, we sort of layer one forecast over another, we sometimes talk about how far we are into the biennium and how much of the revenue that we forecast has already been collected and how much we have yet to see, so sort of how much is in the bank, so to speak. So I think it's useful to just remind ourselves that the FY16-17 revenue forecast is for a biennium that has not yet started, and we have 29 months remaining before the end of that biennium. A lot will happen between now and then, and an illustration of that is these changes in the U.S. economic outlook having to do with oil prices and the strong dollar that were not anticipated as recently as last summer, and changes that have even occurred in those things since the forecast was released. So I will pass it on to Budget Director Kelly.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Doctor, two questions. One, you talked about the price of oil. We have seen an uptick. How much does that change our forecast if we go back to $3.50 or $4 gas, or if we stay down, go back down below $2? I've heard a lot of. I read somewhere that a lot of this forecast was at least secondary benefiting from lower gas prices. But just give us a little bit of a bigger picture.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senators, members of the committee, I don't have a number for how much the forecast changes with any particular change in the price of gas. If you recall the GDP chart that showed this jump in IHS's expectations for 2015, and I said that the largest change there was that change in consumer spending, some of which was due to expectations of lower oil prices, allowing consumers this dividend or being able to divert some of their resources to other kinds of spending, but not all of it. So, and I don't have proportions, but their outlook for consumer spending, I believe, would have increased anyway because of the changes in labor market conditions at the U.S. level. Improved job conditions buoys consumer confidence, and consumer confidence was on the rise before the oil price changes had occurred. So I'm not saying it's not important. It is potentially important, having changes in oil prices, but I don't have a number to put on it. I can tell you, though, that IHS did not expect crude oil prices, for instance, to bottom out and stay at the bottom for a long time. So they have their forecast for oil prices. If you have our full forecast book, you can see it in a chart on page 60. So they have a barrel of Brent crude oil averaging $50 a barrel during the course of this year, with the lower prices being at the beginning of this year and then coming up. And it gets up to 60, I think, in next year. And it gradually gets back to $100 a barrel in 2019. Now, changes have already occurred, and we're already, you know, the crude oil prices are already up higher than that average that they were talking about for this year.
Yeah,
but they could go back down. It's very volatile. So I guess what I'm saying is their forecast had it going down and coming back up. So the risk in our forecast is how different the reality turns out to be, where does it not come down in reality, does not come down as far, does it come back up faster, or does it stay lower longer? Those are both potential risks.
And Mr. Chair, Doctor, I asked a question, and it's all a bit of a guessing game. We're using best estimates and past history and current conditions and all that, but I'm just wondering whether we've maybe not been conservative enough in putting this together, in the sense that, like you say, we're already, last I know, and I don't know what it is in the last week or so, but 60, I think we're over $60 a barrel or thereabout. And so I'd be concerned that does change the prediction quite a bit. Let me shift to the federal side of things, and you were discussing the contemplation of the federal budget not having any hiccups or issues. We've got a debt ceiling increase we're going to be bumping up against here in the next week or so on the federal level. That is just one of many to come, and so what is the basis that they think there won't be any pressure to curb some of the federal spending, which in fact would tighten everybody's situation, perhaps, if the federal government ever does the responsible thing and starts balancing its budget. And so I'm just worried that maybe that's a little bit of an overly optimistic view as well, that generates a overly optimistic projection in our case.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, I think it's very important to look at all of the risks to an economic and revenue forecast.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a forecast that depends on things as unanticipated and as volatile as changes in oil prices and changes in the value of the dollar, then it's particularly important to pay attention to those risks, which is why we lay them out in our documents and in our narratives. With regard to the federal fiscal situation, I'm trying to remember the exact narrative or the exact explanations that IHS gave about fiscal policy, but I believe they were assuming no additional sequestration and no government shutdowns, and their narrative tends to imply that that era isn't so much is the era of fiscal impasses they expect to be over, that Congress is going to not participate in the same kind of brinksmanship with regard to the debt ceiling and other deadlines that they have before. But that's a risk as well. So that's their assessment of what's going to happen. And the U.S. economic outlook that informs Minnesota's outlook is reviewed by our Council of Economic Advisors, and they talked about a number of these risks as well that you're identifying. But they also agreed that the outlook that we were using is reasonable, a reasonable starting point for Minnesota's forecast.
Okay, thank you.
And just want to, I know Senator Newman has a question, but follow up with Senator Westrom. Economically, isn't the bigger risk nationally in terms of an economic shock, the failure to raise the debt ceiling as opposed to anything else the government could do or cannot do?
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to list in my mind all the possible things that could happen. Failure to raise the debt ceiling is, we've been through this. We know that there's there's this time period during which Treasury can continue to pay bills, and then they have no more extraordinary measures. And that would be an enormous shock. That's a big risk. So I guess I can leave it at that. One of the things that we learned during the era of the brinksmanship and federal government shutdown and sequestration is that Minnesota is not a state that's particularly dependent on federal government spending and federal employment. And so we were not harmed in those areas economically as much, or in those periods, as much as some other states were, for instance, Virginia and Maryland, that are so dependent on federal government employment. And so that was a benefit for Minnesota, that when the federal government contracts, it's less of a burden on Minnesota. Something like a debt ceiling breach, which would affect the U.S. economy more broadly, would be felt in Minnesota more than some of the other actions that we've seen by the federal government.
And a second question, again, with apologies to Senator Newman. But Senator Westrom also raised the concern that exists relative to federal deficits. Now, I think the federal deficit number has been halved from where it was 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference if you, the last time there was not a federal deficit was what, 99 or 98 or something? If you hypothetically brought the federal government budget into balance so there's no deficit, what difference does that make in terms of a national economy and a consequence to a Minnesota economy?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there are two impacts here. One would be, so if you could just sort of get to a resolution of the federal government's long-term fiscal challenges. So that means not just resolving the current deficit, but resolving the long-term disconnect between revenue growth and entitlement spending growth. So if that long-term issue was resolved, that's a positive thing for the U.S. economy. To flip it the other way, the fact that the long-term disparity between revenue growth and entitlement spending growth is not resolved, the fact that there is that big gap is currently a drag on the U.S. economy. It's one of the things, in addition to demographic change and the aging of the population, it's one of the two things that is feeding into reduced expectations in the long term for U.S. economic growth. So prior to the Great Recession, the 20-year period prior to the Great Recession, the expectation for annual real GDP growth in the United States, the average, was 3.1%. Going forward, it's about 2.5% annually. And that's due to partly the drag from the long-term federal deficit and changes in demographics. So reversing that could be positive in the long run for the U.S. economy and for Minnesota. However, it depends on how that change is made. Because, as I said, Minnesota is not one of the states that's particularly dependent on federal government spending, although if spending was reduced enough to make these kinds of changes, we'd feel it here too. But if it's done in terms of raising revenues instead, that's where we would feel it in Minnesota. So we're more affected by changes in revenue policy at the federal level than by changes in spending policy. But dramatic changes in spending policy would affect us too.
Senator Newman, I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, if we could go back to your slide, individual income and sales tax receipts. Down at the bottom of that slide, you've listed other resources, and it looks to me like a pretty significant increase of about 41.5%. At least I think I'm looking at that correctly. Could you tell us what those other resources are? And what is causing it? What's the driving force for the increase in those resources?
Sure. That change in other resources reflects a $96 million transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund as a result of resources becoming available in the Healthcare Access Fund. And I will leave it to Budget Director Kelly to share the details on that with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? We can get back to Professor, but Director Kelly, do you want to offer some thoughts then on where we were on the spending side of the equation?
Certainly. Members of the committee, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director. I'm going to speak to the slide titled Forecast Spending Has Been Reduced. We're seeing our spending estimates lowered both in the current biennium and the next biennium, $39 million for fiscal years 14 and 15, and $115 million for fiscal years 16 and 17. The biggest change is within K-12 education. Those estimates are down slightly in fiscal year 14-15, but even more in 16-17, $109 million relative to our November estimates. And this is due primarily to downward revisions of three factors. The first is total pupil counts. Pupil counts are still expected to grow in this forecast year over year. We are lowering our estimated growth slightly based on actual pupil counts reported by school districts. The second factor is compensatory aid, and compensatory aid is one of the main education-driven funding streams for schools, and it is based in part upon poverty and concentration of poverty. And after many years of increasing poverty concentration, the total poverty counts reported to the Department of Education this last December did not increase year over year, and as a result, we reduced our forecast for growth in compensatory aid by $49 million in 16 and 17, and that's the majority of the reduction in that biennium. The final factor for downward revision is special education. Beginning in fiscal year 16 and 17, we have a new formula for special education, and it is based on actual spending in fiscal year 15. So in this forecast, we have actual, more accurate and actual cost data from districts. Prior to this, we had been making estimates. And the formula is based on those actual costs. And as a result, we have lowered our forecast by $33 million as a result of the actual data coming in from school districts. On the property tax aids and credit line, we are estimating slightly lower spending than previously estimated in the November forecast for both biennia. And this is primarily due to lower participation in the homeowner property tax refund program. And we've seen this participation decline in several forecasts now. The Health and Human Services line, the changes here are notable for their lack of change. We were able to incorporate in the November forecast data that typically comes later. It came in earlier around managed care rate changes. And so we saw the majority of our change in the November forecast. The expenditures in fiscal year 14 and 15 have been lowered slightly, $25 million, due largely to lower MA payments for families with children. General fund expenditures in the next biennium are up $14 million, and the majority of this change is due to the use of more expensive services in our chemical dependency treatment program. The debt service line is lowered in the out years due to lower interest rate assumptions in the forecast, and that means future bond sales will be less expensive. And to speak briefly to the healthcare access fund, which is not in this forecast except for the $96 million transfer, expenditures have been lowered. Enrollment is lowered in the healthcare access fund on our basic health plan. Tax revenues are up slightly, and federal participation has increased as well. And so we had been estimating a $62 million deficit in that fund, and we now have a $13 million positive balance. The fund improved sufficiently that a transfer in law was triggered. $96 million was transferred from the healthcare access fund into the general fund, and that is the biggest piece of the non-tax revenue changes that you saw on the earlier slides.
And Kelly, if I might, I understand that there are going to be a couple of adjustments, I think, with what I'm told, a couple of the agencies. Did I misstate?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're talking about a letter that should be coming to you all today or tomorrow. Speaking to an error that we did have in the forecast, about $1.7 million of spending that was underestimated. So our spending side will be a little bit higher than we had thought. The balance will be lowered somewhat by $1.7 million. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. So we'll have to determine who's going to pay for that, at least within the divisions. So it's a runoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, could you shed some light on the discrepancy in the pupil numbers? Because I would think that when we do our forecast, we use the census numbers. And so what would account for such a wide differential in what we projected versus actual?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the change in pupil counts is relatively minor. It's like 0.1% change. And it is based on actual data as well as projections going forward. So we do use our census count to look forward in terms of estimating how many students we will have in our schools. But at the same time, families move in and out of the state or in and out of districts. And so we inform our future projections based on actual enrollment, and they have come in slightly lower than we thought they would, and so we've lowered our projections slightly going forward.
Mr. Chair, so for example, in the 2016-17, I thought I heard you say the change in compensatory was $49 million, and so then the balance of that $109 was the change in pupils, and so even though it was such a small percent, it resulted in that much of a change?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the change in special education was about $33
million. Oh, okay.
And so the change in pupil counts was, I think, just around $20-25 million.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kelly, the debt service projections, can you tell me how you come about the lower interest rates moving forward? Is it how that's projected?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we use assumptions built into the IHS forecast for interest rates. We use those assumptions for determining if we were to sell bonds of a specified amount, and our forecast assumes, I believe it's 775, getting a no, seven, I'm forgetting the numbers.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding it's 220 for the fiscal 15 session, and it would be $800 million in the subsequent biennium or the subsequent session.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. We base our assumptions on a 10-year rolling average of actual authorized bond sales, and so given those amounts and given the assumptions in the IHS forecast for debt for interest rates, we assume what the cost of debt would be.
Not sure for other questions. Professor, if I could get back to yourself. You've discussed the fact that the economic expansion we now have is fairly lengthy. And we've had discussion of, you know, has a unique feature been some wage suppression. Separate from that, for our purposes of this session, We talk about, you know, should we take the surplus and reduce income taxes, raise income taxes, spend it all, do whatever we want to do with it. How much longer would you expect an economic expansion? I mean, is there a chance we're walking into given the fact there's more globalization than might have been the case 20 years ago, are we walking into a situation where you could foresee indefinite economic expansion, even if it's not at the level of, say, 99, 2000, and you have a GDP increase of, what, 5% per year? But could you see an ongoing constant of 2.5, 3% GDP increase for X number of years to come? Or at some point, do things just in a natural economic cycle catch up to us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, with confidence, I can forecast that we are not going to have an indefinite economic expansion, that at some point it will turn down because that's what business cycles do. The economy expands and then we have a contractionary period. So while the average annual expected real GDP growth going forward is something like 2.5%. That doesn't mean that every year we can expect that. What we can expect is an expansion to lead to, ultimately to lead to a contraction or a recession. As I said, and you reiterated, the expansion period that we're in now is getting a little long in the tooth, and so it becomes riskier and riskier to forecast out years of continued expansion and continued growth. That at some point it's going to turn down. I can't tell you exactly what point that is. And neither does IHS Economics. They'll tell us that we're in a contraction when we're in one, really.
If we look at that historically, say, post-World War II, what's been average expansion versus average contraction? And what's the variable in terms of number of years where that's happened? A 5-year expansion followed by a 3-year contraction, and what's been our history?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't have at my fingertips the length of the typical or average recession, but the average recovery and expansion period, so the white space in my unemployment chart, is 5.5 years.
And we're now at what point?
We'll be there. We're close to that. We'll be there sometime this summer, I think. Or no, I'm sorry. I take that back. We're past that.
Okay.
The expansion that we're in now is longer than the average post-war expansion.
And your IHS predictions contained in what you present to us show an expansion lasting for another, 3 or 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that would put us at about a 10-year expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that post-World War II?
The big one. The expansion of the 1990s was however long that was.
Okay. And that was based upon the dot-com expansion, the reverse mortgage expansion, and some relatively weak underpinnings to the economy. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, and I think it would we wouldn't, if we were going to speculate about the nature of this expansion or any other expansionary period, I don't think we'd look to an outlier like that one and say that's the kind of expansion we should expect to see now.
Okay. So assuming that was unique, both in a positive and a negative way,
mm-hmm.
And understanding that you're not predicting where we might be in 30 years,
mm-hmm.
talked about some problems that might take place with the economy over the X number of years. Maybe as we get into the 2020s, an explosion in entitlement spending, I assume, might be a factor. Where federal revenues just overwhelm federal receipts. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a fair hypothetical. But one thing that you've discussed before, and Dr. Stinson prior to you, over the last several years, has been the uncertainty as to foreign markets. And we talk about the Greek financial crisis and what's taking place with some parts of Western Europe. That never seems to materialize in terms of an American economy. So is that receding in terms of a concern as to what happens with foreign markets?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the international geopolitical risk is always with us and every year takes on forms that we couldn't have imagined the year prior. I wouldn't say it's receding. What I would say is that during the Great Recession, where not only the U.S. went into recession, but other countries did too, and in the United States' recovery from that recession, it was kind of surprising how much investment continued to come to the United States, sort of because we were the best performing economy among a whole bunch of badly performing economies. Poor performing economies. So it's relative to other countries, our economy looks strong, but relative to our history, the recovery looks sluggish. So I think even in the medium term, it's hard to forecast what the impact on the U.S. economy is going to be of changes in other countries. But we are dependent on global economic growth for demand for our products. And so if the European Union does not recover fully, if China doesn't begin to grow a little better, if Japan doesn't recover fully, then that's going to be a challenge for the U.S. economy.
And also, just kind of change subjects a little bit. We've been in a period of pretty limited inflationary growth. At some point, does that take off, mm-hmm. where inflation becomes more of a drag on the economy than it's been? I think what's inflation's been at, what, like 1.5% to 2% or something?
Mr. Chairman, yes, U.S. inflation has been below the Fed's target rate of 2%, and that's been one of the interesting challenges of this recovery, is all of the quantitative easing and accommodative monetary policy that the Fed has tried has not brought inflation up to their target. And so this is part of the years of speculation about when is the Fed going to change behavior. There is a school of thought among macroeconomists that Americans have gotten so used to low prices and low inflation that it wouldn't take a large change in inflation for that to have a pretty dramatic effect on consumer spending. So whereas in the past, when we were used to higher inflation, changes in inflation didn't shock us that much. Now, having gotten used to years and years of below 2%, inflation wouldn't have to get up too high for that to have a potentially damaging effect on the economy.
So the message to policymakers, whether in this building, across the street, or nationally, is we should try to be careful and not go crazy one way or another. Would that be that's not an economic term, I don't believe, but would that be fair advice to us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I were to offer advice, not go crazy would be at the top of the list. The reason that we do explain all of the risks and describe the risks and have an outside counsel look at the forecast and share all of this information with you is so that you know the risks that you're dealing with. This is an important lesson in what the purpose of budget reserves is, to ensure against downside risk in an economic and revenue forecast.
And that leads to my last question relative to this. So what about a budget reserve? We're at, about $1.3 billion, including the cash flow account. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the Budget Trends Commission, which was co-chaired by Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Kudrowski, suggested a combination of reserves at, I think, $2 billion? Follow the number?
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember exactly the number that came out of that report. I can tell you the number that comes out of our annual analysis.
Right. So if you were to advise us, what would you want us to do with the budget reserve, if anything?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so as you know, out of the Long-Term Budget Trend Study Commission came some analysis on the volatility of Minnesota's tax revenue streams. That analysis that was done by Professor Stinson and Matt Shepner in my office, that has evolved into an annual report that my office puts out, that MMB puts out, that analyzes the volatility of the revenue streams, and using that information, the volatility of the tax system and the size of total revenues, makes a recommendation for the size of the budget reserve. And the recommendation for the current biennium, fiscal year 14-15, is 5.1% of non-dedicated revenues for the biennium, which is $1.990 billion. For the coming biennium, fiscal year 16-17, it's 5.2% of non-dedicated revenues, which is $2.166 billion. And so that's the recommended level of the reserves. That is also the statutory target for the budget reserve, and so replenishing, adding to that reserve up to that target satisfies the or manages risk to the level that that of risk tolerance that we describe in the report.
Okay, so using your figures, we're still upwards of $800 million under that optimum number for a budget reserve.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
That arithmetic would suggest that. And so when we look at a $1.8 billion projected surplus, that doesn't take into account anything additional. You've already put into the forecast for November some additional monies into the reserve, correct?
Mr. Chairman, in the past November forecast, we had the automatic trigger of 33% of the positive forecast balance going into the reserve, and that put in $183 million. That trigger is in place for next November as well, but I'm not forecasting what that forecast will say.
Yeah. That obviously was based on the law of 2 years ago, but we still have we're not reaching that optimum number for a budget reserve that you would suggest, and that's even separate from this issue of, do we ever put inflation back in the budget forecast? Fair statement?
That's correct.
So the message to this committee, and I'm maybe putting words into your mouth, and you don't have to respond necessarily, but what I'm hearing from you is the message to this committee and the message to the Senate Tax Committee and our counterparts across the street is be careful that we have a lengthy economic expansion, one that goes beyond historic trends, and we have a budget reserve, including the cash flow account, that you can make an argument, despite the fact that it's at probably an historic level, is still underfunded.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly can say that the budget reserve that we have, the budget reserve level we have now, is underfunded relative to our recommendations for appropriate managing of risk given the volatility of our revenue streams.
So this is a little bit of an editorial comment, but on my particular bete noire, probably not a good idea to give out $175 rebates as an example. But you don't necessarily have to respond to that.
Thank you.
Other questions for either Professor Lomakaitis or Director Kelly about this? Anything else? Well, Mr. Nauman reminded me, you know, I know that at the time of the council meeting, there was some discussion of concerns about if the IHS forecast would be in time for our forecast. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a bill that changes things a little bit. Any interest on the part of the department relative to that, to change the timing a little bit, or is that just a variance depending on where IHS is at any given time?
Mr. Chairman, if I remember correctly, this the change is to allow under current law, the forecast is to be released by the last day of February.
Yeah.
And I believe the change is to, if the last day of February falls on the weekend, then we can release the forecast 2 days into the week. So on Tuesday, March 1st.
That's
or March 2nd.
That's still satisfactory.
I don't know if either of you want to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, this year was a little unfortunate in terms of the lateness of the IHS information. I think the concern is I'm sitting between two people and would like to move it in two different directions. part of the problem is, to the extent we delay it into March, then we get into the March madness, so to speak, of the budget process, the budget preparation. And so that delays our ability to provide a supplemental budget to the governor. So it's one of those, you push here and it moves a little bit on the other side. So I think at this point we haven't really taken a position.
No, I just wondered. That's all right. Well, I appreciate the comments from both of you. It's always very instructive for us and for any of us who took an econ course in college. It's a lot more interesting listening to both of you than some of my econ class, but thank you.
It's true.
So the other thing we have on the agenda is the proposed confirmation of Commissioner Franz as Commissioner of MMB. We have in front of us the Commissioner's resume. Commissioner, any comments you'd like to make to the committee?
Mr. Chair, my colleagues are abandoning me at the table here, so I don't know if that's good or bad. Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I appreciate the committee's consideration of my confirmation as Commissioner of MMB. I will say that some of my friends give me a little kid me a little bit about not being born in Minnesota, but my retort to them is I chose Minnesota. So when I was practicing law in Washington, D.C. in 1985, at a tax law firm there, I decided to look around and see where I might go and move and have a different kind of practice than what's available in D.C. And I looked all around the country, and I selected Minneapolis and the Twin Cities, Minnesota, for a particular several reasons, and one of which it had the highest number of Fortune 500 companies for its size. It had a robust economy. It had a very sound and ethical legal community. So I made that selection, and boy, was I right. I mean, when I look back at all the decisions I've made in my life, have not all been good. But I will tell you that that particular one was great. The opportunity to move to Minnesota, and for the last 30 years to think about the growth and the opportunities that I've had in working for two different really great law firms, the Great Plant Moody and Bennett Law Firm, and Fagry & Benson, now Fagry & Baker & Daniels. the opportunities that I was afforded are just unbelievable in terms of working for some of the clients that we've had here, that we have in Minnesota, or I call them clients. They're businesses in Minnesota. I just learned an amazing amount of information. I had an opportunity, for example, to work on the Honeywell purchase of the Sperry Aerospace business in the late 1980s. It's just so many different opportunities that I've had here in Minnesota that I feel really blessed. I met a beautiful Minnesota woman that is now my wife. We have two wonderful Minnesota boys. So I couldn't be more proud of the opportunity to serve this state. But that's all I'll say for now. I'll let you ask questions.
Questions for the commissioner. I note that you spent a little bit of time in American Samoa, so that you're the first commissioner of finance we've seen that has has an American Samoan background, but I think. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'd like to follow up on the chair's newly minted term of art of whether or not we should go crazy with the budget surplus. Seems to me that there's several things that we could do. You know, we could spend it, we could save it, we could issue Jesse checks, we could provide tax relief. I'd be interested in knowing what your recommendation would be to the legislature as to what do we do with the budget surplus and why.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, thank you for that opportunity to answer that question. You know, when I started as the Revenue Commissioner back in 2011, and we were all faced with a $6 billion, then $5 billion deficit, that was a different situation to say the least. And several people came to me and said that former Commissioner Peter Hutchinson said, "Someday, Myron, I hope you have a surplus to deal with." Well, here we are. So I think the perspectives that we've talked about here today are instructive in terms of there are always risks associated with these forecasts. There are risks associated with all kinds of different opportunities. And I think that my recommendation both to the governor and to this body is to spend and invest that money in those opportunities that will provide long-term growth and opportunity for people in Minnesota. One of the issues that we've struggled with in this recovering economy is the slowness in wage growth, the slowness in job growth, and it's finally starting to get there. We're finally starting to see the growth in wages and in jobs, but I think the key is to make sure that those opportunities, those jobs continue in the future, and I think everyone has sort of realized that the investing in education, investing in young people, investing in our higher education system is one of the hallmarks of what has made Minnesota so great over the last many decades. And it continues to, when you look at some of our neighbors who are not have the resources to invest like we do in higher education and lower and E-12 education, I think that Minnesota is poised with the proper investment to sort of double down on its success and make sure that in the future people see Minnesota as increasing opportunities through education and the infrastructure. So I think we have to be careful in how we spend. We have to be careful in what we decide to return in the way of tax cuts or tax credits. You know, the lesson of the late 1999 and 2000 where we had a lot of money coming into the Treasury at that point, and we gave a lot of it back, some of it understandable, but we also reduced rates, income tax rates and some other rates. And what we saw with the dot-com bubble bursting in 2000, how quickly the economic situation can turn around on us. So I think, as Dr. Kalambakides has mentioned, there are a lot of risks here. We need to manage those risks. We need to be thoughtful. And I, for one, am very proud of the way we've been able to increase the reserve by $333 million this last year. The rating companies, when they look at Minnesota, the rating companies look at our increased reserves, they look at our balanced budget, they look at the fact that we've paid back all the money we borrowed from the schools, but they also look at us. They look at us in the sense of how well does the House and the Senate and the governor decide on a budget, and will they meet their budgetary deadline by May 18th and come up with a balanced budget that works going forward. They look to us to see how well we function, how well we govern and make these difficult decisions. So I think that all speaks for being cautious, being careful as we go forward.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'll ask you just a couple of questions if I could. How is the previous Commissioner of Revenue for 4 years prepared you for this? And then I'll follow up with another question about being careful, your comments about being careful. How has he prepared you?
Mr. Chair, Senator, an enormous opportunity for me personally for the last 4 years as Revenue Commissioner to understand the dynamic way that the Minnesota economy grows and how the economy generates income. I mean, I learned probably the most I've ever learned in my life the first several years when I was traveling around the state, talking to people about what do they see, what do they see as the problems in our budget process or taxes, and what do they see as the opportunities, and they all would tell me, almost to a single, every single one would say they were concerned about getting value for their dollars. They wanted to make sure that they're willing and able to pay taxes, but their number one concern was not the amount of tax or the rate of tax. It was, are they getting value? So if they're paying their tax dollars, is the educational system working? You know, is the infrastructure there to deliver their product or help them to deliver their service or their business company? So that to me, taught me a lot about how important it is as a commissioner of any agency to make sure that agency functions very well, as efficiently as possible, and returns value for every dollar that it gets from the taxpayer. And the other really important thing that I learned, once again, from traveling around the state and talking to people was their desire that we all work together, that we come up with solutions that... And I benefited from being traveling around the state a lot during a time when there had been a lot of animosity and concern and rancor, and people are really tired of that. They really they look to us to disagree about stuff, but they look to us to come up with a solution that solves a problem that keeps this state moving. So that gave me the sense of how important it is to be accessible to you all as policymakers, to make sure that the information I have is available to you, is available to the public, so that everyone is on the same set. We can argue about policy, but we shouldn't be arguing about the facts. And so I think I've learned as Revenue Commissioner to be as transparent and as open as I possibly can to you all as I work through this process.
Thank you, and then I'll just finish with this, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate the comments about you traveling the state of Minnesota and visiting with people. And I, too, agree that they, you know, one of their big discussions is, and has been for a long time, we need to work together, get along down there. And you know, you hear this all the time. But what I also see after being here 9 years, times we do work together, it doesn't get reported much. So, you know, you find yourself telling the folks that yes, in fact, we do actually pass a lot of bills and we do a lot of stuff together, and they just don't hear that. But now when you take on a commissioner role, you have a lot of constituents, as we all do. We all have about the same amount and fairly close. How am I, with the most current budget proposals, how am I, and the numbers I'm getting are from nonpartisan staff, that the governor is looking at potentially, or at least his proposals are, to hire 2,400 new FTEs statewide. So how do I go back to my constituents and say, in this time when they're, you know, they're coming out. I mean, the report is good. We're coming out of a recession. Things are starting to look good. They're starting to spend some money, so we're reaping the benefits here at the state of Minnesota, and we're going to be growing government by 2,400 employees. That's what I'm going to hear. They're not even going to ask where. They're just going to hear an awful lot of employees. Could you comment on how I should answer that or what your thoughts are?
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, that's an excellent question, and I get their concern. I think part of what is sometimes missed by folks is their demand for more services. They don't always realize that means it requires more people to deliver those services. And one of the things we're seeing is an increased demand for services. We're seeing a growing population, We're seeing an increased demand for services, and that means, I don't know what the exact number is going to be when we all get done at the end of the at this session here, but that does mean that in some cases it requires more people. Better government doesn't always mean smaller government. Better government sometimes means you need more people to deliver the services. So I think it's incumbent upon us to explain where the new FTEs are coming from and why they're there. I can confirm that the governor has the same concern, and he looks at every agency and every budget request, and he says, why do you need more? Do you need more? What are you doing? Are you successful at what you're doing? Why do you need more? And so I pledge to you to work with you as we work through this budget process to make sure we know why those new FTEs are being added, what value they're going to bring to the taxpayers, because I think that's a critical answer. But we need to break it down in order to answer that question to the individual taxpayers.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think your department does the fiscal notes. And I was wondering a couple things. One, it seems like when I visit with some of my colleagues who are chairing committees or members who have had legislation that has a fiscal impact, that the fiscal notes are coming in slower and slower. The other issue that I have is in the fiscal note itself, and I brought this up when I was in state government, we usually give the cost for the current year, which would be, 2015 and or 16, no, 15, and then the next biennium. And what I thought would be helpful would be if you could see the previous biennium, not just the year that we're in, so that you could actually, as a legislator, look at the fiscal note and see from biennium to biennium what that increase would be. And we can find it, obviously, but usually we don't have a lot of time when we're going through budgets and things like that. So just couple thoughts that I have. The other one that I was going to ask maybe isn't quite fair. I was going to ask you if you had a choice of buying an Arctic Cat ATV or a Polaris ATV, which one would you choose?
That's a trick question.
You don't have to answer that one.
If you use either one, you could answer.
He's further from Roses, state Polaris.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Senator, I think based on your invitation to come visit your area, we might want to I forget the name of the model you were talking about that we should go test out. What was the name? What was the name of that model, sir?
Well, there's a Razor, and there's several others that I think we should test out.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I must. You don't know this, but when I was in high school, I got on a motorcycle made an error in judgment and had a pretty severe accident. So you may not want to let me be in the driver's seat for your time.
I think, Senator Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question about the governor's proposal for 2,400 new FTEs, have you given any analysis to that? How much would that increase our budget? And in light of a relatively stagnant but hopeful inflationary period, is that a wise decision to go forward?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think one of the things that we try to analyze that is really agency by agency, and does the agency that's requesting an increase in FTE, what's the rationale for that increase? Why? What purpose are they going to serve? Are they going to further the mission of the agency? And I think we have to be careful that when we do these things, but I think we also have demands by different groups and different folks who want more services, who want more more opportunities that we can provide in some agencies. So I think we do have to look at that carefully, and we will analyze that cautiously as we go forward. I think that as we go through the bill process and the budget process with the various committees, you'll have an opportunity to understand why each agency is requesting an additional FTE or what that amount is for, and we'll try to make that as obvious and as clear as we can.
Mr. Chair, I remember a while back that Tim Pawlenty once recognized Minnesota in some type of speech or maybe an answer to a question on some stump somewhere, but he said that Minnesota is a high service state. He recognized that and the difficulty in trying to control or reduce the state budget. It raises the question of, do we want Minnesota to continue to be a high service state? Do we want Minnesota to offer even more services at more cost to the average taxpayer? And I was wondering if, Commissioner, you could give me a vision of what you think Minnesota should be when it comes to services. Are we too many? Are we, certainly we're projecting 2,400 new employees to expand services. So am I right in assuming that you want Minnesota to be a higher service state?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think one of the things that I've learned since moving here, and one of the reasons I moved here 30 years ago, was because Minnesota was a high-value, high-service state even at that time. And I was talking with a CFO of a large company in Minnesota maybe 2 years ago who had moved from the East Coast 10 years ago or so, and he said people here sometimes forget how many things work in Minnesota as opposed to in other states. The value, the level of service, the level of commitment that we have by our civil servants is really quite good. Our teachers, our firemen and firewomen, and the police officers, and the Department of Transportation, you look at the work they do. It really is an amazing. We have a very talented workforce. We have a smart workforce, a talented workforce. So I believe we have a high value, a high service state, and I wouldn't want to see that erode. But I think it's you just don't add FTEs for the sake of adding FTEs. I think you have to be concerned about quality. You have to be concerned about what is the mission, what is that agency doing, and why does it need 2 or 3 or 4, 10 more people to do that. So I believe that the agency heads try to make those determinations, and that's what we'll try to do going forward.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Lemon.
There's a proposal, I think, floating around the Capitol for a legislative budget office, something modeled after the government accounting office in Washington. And do you think that's something that we should pursue?
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, I read the OLA report from 2012. The Office of Legislative Auditor did a full, as you recall, full-blown review of the fiscal note process in 2012. And in that report, I didn't realize that the fiscal note process this year now is 41 years old in terms of being housed by the administration and the thousands and thousands of fiscal notes that have been prepared. So recall that MMB's role in the fiscal note process is one to coordinate and review. So whenever there's a fiscal note request, most of the time it's for other agencies, MMB coordinates the information that and also reviews and sends over the fiscal note when completed. And so I think the other thing that the OLA report mentioned, there was no one could cite to a particular instance where either the governor's office or the commissioner's office had any influence or over the fiscal note process. I think we have an extremely talented, nonpartisan component in the agencies and at MMB, talented professional people who work really hard to prepare these notes as quickly as they can and as objectively as they can. So no matter where the fiscal note process is housed, whether it's in the legislature or in the executive, it's going to require a pretty incredible, a lot of information and support by the executive to get the information. We think the process is working very well. We don't think the process is broken, and we believe it should remain the way that it is, and then any changes would require additional monies to make changes. So I've talked to the governor about it. I've explained to him how strongly we feel about it, how we believe it really is functioning properly, and we support the system as it currently is.
So, Senator Limmer, if you allow me a couple of responses to your questions, if that's okay. Just on the employment issue, Deed just released this morning the employment figures for Minnesota, which showed that every sector of the economy gained jobs in this last quarter, except for three. Construction lost 137 jobs. Information services lost 227 jobs, and government lost 918 jobs. And so government is the one sector that's lagging behind the rest of the state economy in terms of job growth. Now, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, something we can discuss in this committee as things proceed this year. I would hope if we look at the 2,400 proposed FTEs, however, we'll also look at any FTE growth at a city, county, and township level as well, because I'll bet those increases are greater than the state. The second, if you'll allow me an editorial comment, is we actually, Commissioner, I had a proposal for a legislative budget office, I think somewhere around 2,000. The author of that proposal spent a decent amount of time working on it. It was not dissimilar to what's being discussed now. And the author of the proposal came to the conclusion that it was not a very smart idea and withdrew the bill and never asked for a hearing. And the author was myself. And I spent some time with that and came to the conclusion that, at least in the context of the state of Minnesota, it was a bad idea. Maybe this year there might be other reasons to take a look at it again, but I spent a lot of time on it back then and came to the conclusion that it was not a wise idea. And that was not at a time of a DFL governor. Yes, I did that during Governor Ventura's administration. So we'll have a chance to discuss that issue in the context of this committee, I'm sure. Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting the different theories in how we all believe differently at the table that we think government should grow with the private sector when it comes to services and jobs. And Commissioner, you certainly talked about service. That's what we do. That's what we provide. I've been involved in service for my whole life, and I understand that. It's just where do you find that balance and where do you, as Senator Limmer talks about, where's the balance of too much in the eyes of some as far as service. But one of the things that's concerning and should be to all of us, and most recently in the news, is the protection of sensitive information. And obviously you're going to be overseeing some real sensitive stuff here, and we have these hackers now that are getting into the systems. Not only the ISIS terrorist scene, but the other hackers that are and can possibly make life real miserable financially, which in some cases can probably not take us to our knees, but be very, very problematic for us. What things have you put in place, and are you monitoring that really well? Give us a little flavor of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's an excellent question. We're very concerned about that, obviously. And I think when I was at the Department of Revenue was something we were concerned about, the tax, people stealing identities and tax fraud. And so it's something that we monitored very closely. And also I've talked with Commissioner Baden, the Minute Commissioner, about protections of – we have a lot of sensitive data, and we're – all businesses, all governments are subject to being attacked in this cyber attack way, and we have to be diligent. We have to continually strive to update our information and our protection systems. And I know that we've had a rash of attempts here in the last several months. And one of the things that we want to do is to continue to upgrade. Most of the larger agencies typically have pretty decent or good fraud protections, and sometimes some of the smaller agencies that haven't been able to afford to kind of keep up. So I know that Commissioner Baden is working to try to make sure that the enterprise as a system is fully protected. But we are very concerned about that, and we're really trying to make sure that we have all the right protections. But it's something you really have to think about sort of day to day in terms of what's the new threat, what's the new thing you have to work for. So we I can just tell you that we take very seriously the threat to the confidentiality of government data.
Do we have further questions for Commissioner Franz?
Well,
or
Mr. Chair, on that point, if I could give just a suggestion to Commissioner Franz, and this would be a suggestion to any commissioner that has intimate financial data or health data, is that those of us on the Judiciary Committee, we handle a lot of the data privacy issues, but we don't hear from any commissioners regarding the difficulty they have or the threats that they may be aware of. We don't. And if we're the ultimate policymakers in the state to make these decisions, we need to know what you are facing. And we even have a data privacy commission now that runs year-round. And Senator Dibble is the chair of that. And I think it would be in the best interest of our taxpayers to make sure that we understand what your threats are. And I just know that I've never, in all the time I've been in office, I've never had a sit-down meeting with a commissioner telling me what challenges they're facing on in that discipline. So I certainly would encourage that.
Other questions for Commissioner Franz or motions? Senator Stumpf?
I'd be happy to make the motion.
All right, Senator Stumpf moves. The Senate Finance Committee recommends to the Senate the confirmation of Myron Franz as Commissioner of the Department of Management and Budget. If there's no further discussion on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, and committee, thank you very much.
Went too fast.